So Brian, I appreciate you taking some time out to be with me today, and it's just an honor to have you on. I know a lot of people follow your work and are just really impressed by what you've done in discussing worldviews and discerning worldviews. It's been really helpful for readers to have that, and also your novels, all the things you've done in apologetics and in film. So it's a great privilege to have you on. I appreciate you taking some time out for me today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So, for those who may not be familiar with your background, I thought we might just start by you telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in screenwriting and your experience as a screenwriter, as a filmmaker. Just kind of give us a little bit of a background.
Sure. I've always been an artist and when I went to college, I was actually trained as a visual artist in graphic design and illustration and such. But over the years, throughout my whole life, I always loved movies. I just love movies, And so when I got out of college, I actually got to know a filmmaker friend who taught me sort of I'd not gone to school for filmmaking, so he had started to teach me about filmmaking because he was a filmmaker himself. And it kind of became an inspiration for me to pursue it on the side. And so the one thing I knew that I could pursue on my own without having to, put in the education and get crews and all that was screenwriting. And so I did. I started screenwriting fresh out of college. And so basically was self-taught, wrote for many years, did several scripts, did all the things. I basically just bought all the books on how to break into the business and what to do, and I followed them. And cold calling, pounding the streets, going to festivals and competitions and stuff like that. So I won a bunch of little awards and stuff for my scripts as the years went on. But the first movie that as they often say in Hollywood, used to be your 10-year overnight success, but now it's a 20-year overnight success. So, you're working 10, 15 years sometimes before you could actually break through and get a movie made because movies are so impossible to get made, that's one of the reasons why we often encourage people that if there's anything else you can do, if you love movies and you want to be in the movie business, if there's anything else you can do it because it's so grueling and so near impossible that it's got to be everything you're doing, everything you're interested, no social life type of thing, 24/7 almost. And a lot of people's lives are ruined because of that. So it's hard to strike a balance. But nevertheless, my first movie got made in like 2001, To End All Wars. And from there, I thought, oh, now I'm going to have this great career and everything's going to open up for me. And it doesn't happen that way. There are some, flashes where people sell a script and then all of a sudden everyone wants them and stuff. But most people, you kind of got to go back to the drawing board, back to square one, start pounding the streets for your next script. And, it does, people do hear about you when the movie gets out, and it did help me get some meetings and such. But at the end of the day, I'm an independent filmmaker, okay? So I'm not in the studio system, making a Marvel movie or anything like that. So as an independent filmmaker, you're making these smaller films that are more meaningful, but they're also, you've got to do more of the work yourself type of thing. And so, from there it kind of grew. And I've always, I've been a Christian, not always, but I've been a Christian for much of my life. And I've always had an interest in apologetics. And philosophy. And so that sort of drove me to look at, as I was learning how to write screenplays and such, I was developing what we would call an aesthetic. And what that is that's a philosophy of beauty. You hear about in philosophy, you have the threefold sort of approach to philosophy where you have an ethic, you have an ontology, and you have an epistemology. Epistemology is how do you know what you know? Ethics are, of course, morals and what is right and wrong. And an ontology is what is a notion of reality. And that's sort of a threefold element of philosophy. But that's not everything, and that's a very that can be a very limiting definition, even though it's, you know, it's been used for, you know, for the history of philosophy, because beauty is also another element of a philosophy. What is beauty? And so I was, as I was learning about storytelling to become a professional storyteller, I saw how it reflected a lot of my faith. And I'd been a Christian, you know, like I said, for many years. And my, you know, the question was how do I integrate my faith with my storytelling, you know? And I came to realize there's a really, actually storytelling in a way is quite apologetic. And we could get into more details, but I started to realize that the nature of storytelling itself is actually a paradigm of conversion. And that's what sort of inspired me to write Hollywood Worldviews, my book, which now, you know, it's all over they use in a lot of Christian colleges and such to teach these elements, because I was always interested in worldviews, always interested in, you know, how are stories, how are movies communicating of the worldview to people? And, you know, I remember my friends would always, you know, sort of mock me. Oh, Godow, you take it too seriously. It's not that deep, blah, 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 blah. No. I'm telling you, you know, movies have a philosophy to them. They have a worldview. And so I finally put that in a book, and a lot of my friends, you know, finally came around and came to realize, yeah, you know, you're right. It changes the way I watch movies. Now I can't watch a movie without spotting all that stuff, you know? So what I did in the book was, you know, I think also in the church, there's Christians are often woefully unprepared to counter the world, secular world around them. And that, thus, you know, the need for apologetics, you know? And I think that Christians just don't, they don't tend to take that stuff seriously until they're really put up against the wall and slammed by some, you know, skeptical person who's read some Richard Dawkins book or something, you know, or, you know, regurgitating their, you know, little questions about Christianity or the Bible that they learned in college. Or Christians go to college themselves and they get in classes and their faith gets slammed. And maybe only then is when they start to realize, maybe I need to have a, you know, stronger understanding of my faith. And I think the root of that comes in beginning to understand the nature of worldviews and how, you know, rather than, you know, asking yourself, how do I learn all the answers to all the questions that I'm getting? If you study the nature of worldviews and what they are and what they contain, and understand your own worldview well, then you're able to address them. But as I, you know, that's the intellectual side of Christianity. But there's also, you know, what I would call, you know, the beauty side, and not just the emotional side, but the beauty side, meaning, you know, like I said, as I've always been an artist, but we tend to dichotomize our life between the secular and the sacred. You know, we have the sacred things in life, reading the Bible, going to church, fellowship, and all that stuff, which is good. But then we have our secular, which is our job and watching TV or doing the dishes, you know, that kind of stuff. And I think that you know, the I read a lot of Francis Schaeffer when I was younger, and he helped me begin to synthesize those two aspects of life so that everything I do in the name of Jesus Christ. Well, how do I wash dishes for Christ? How do I, you know, how do I do my job for Christ and stuff? You know, what if you're a plumber? How can you serve Christ as a plumber? Well, you can actually. And that's the beginning of understanding how your faith really does integrate into everything. Well, as I was learning storytelling, I was seeing this same, a lot of similar elements of what I was learning about my faith and about apologetics. For example, the story structure itself, like, you know, if you've ever taken an art appreciation class, you know, where you know, they teach you, oh, like maybe how to appreciate music, right? You know, here's harmony, here's consonants, dissonance, whatever, all the elements of music, or a painting class. You know, here's how you appreciate painting. You've got form, you've got color. They teach you about composition, you know, that kind of a thing. Well, I wanted to have a art appreciation class for movies for Christians, because I felt like, as I looked out in the church at that time around me, I think it's very different now than it was, you know, 25 years ago. But But at the time, you know, Christians did not know how to cope with movies. A lot of them loved movies, but it would be sort of a guilty pleasure, right? But you either there was two I saw two extremes. You know, I saw the cultural anorexic, as I call them, and those were the Christians who would say, "Oh, there's sex and violence in movies, so I stay away from all of it," you know. And then you've got the opposite side, which is, you know, the cultural gluttons, I call them, which they recognize that they have a freedom in Christ. You're not, you know, just because there's some sex or violence or language in a movie doesn't mean it's, you know, you can't watch it necessarily. And there, you know, you have to have a mature approach to that. But a lot of times those people would say, well, hey, I'm free in Christ, so it doesn't affect me. It's just a movie, right? So I kind of wanted to address both of those extremes in the church and help Christians to interpret movies better and realize that they're actually communicating a worldview. Movies are doing that. And you know, my stress at that time was movies, but of course now I think with the power of Netflix and the advent of you know, the best storytelling is now really more in series, you know, not even TV anymore, it's streaming series. Those are the best storytelling. But I found that the nature of storytelling itself actually was a paradigm of conversion. And that was really a powerful thing to me, because what that means is if you can understand how a story is leading you through persuasive ideas, you know, then you can be more aware of it. You can be less vulnerable to the bad ideas, but also you can spot the good ideas as well. This isn't a question of, you know, another thing that I was not was a media watchdog who's out there pointing out all the bad stuff in movies and television. I don't, I'm not into that. Now, there is a lot of bad stuff, no doubt. But I think there's a lot of good stuff that you know, Christians can actually miss if because they're throwing the baby out with the bathwater, that kind of a thing. So the goal was discernment, not throw it all out or just suck it all in, but discerning the good from the bad and using that as a way to talk to other people. You know, I mean, like so many people would watch so many movies and television, and it would just go, "Oh, did you see this such movie? Yeah, oh yeah, it's great. Yeah, I loved it too." But really, you know, every Monday morning, when you know you're around the water cooler at work, it's like, what if you saw the latest movie and it really was something meaningful that and you could learn how to talk about, well, here's what I liked about the movie, but then here's what I didn't like. And basically, I could talk about Christ applied to any movie. And this isn't a gimmick. This isn't, you know, learn how to turn every talk about a movie into the gospel. But the truth is if movies really are communicating a worldview on life, well then, you know, my reaction to that involves my faith and what I disagree or agree with. And so that's what I would often do is I would, you know, basically talk about the gospel, you know, a lot when I would talk about movies. So Hollywood Worldviews was my attempt to try to sort of share some of that material with Christians so that they can begin to appreciate it and you know, integrate it more into their lives and be more discerning about it.
You bring up so many good points here, and that is, you know, I think there's something to analytic philosophy and studying apologetics and then creativity. And sometimes we put one in one category and one in the other. And I like I was reading your website and you say your left brain and your right brain work, you know, together. And I think that's something that's lost on a lot of people, and it's really important. You know, art and beauty and you know, engaging the culture is just as much a part of sharing the truth of Christianity as putting together you know, a strong philosophy. You talk about worldviews, and you know, I wonder if you know, that's a term that that some people define differently or maybe don't totally understand. So whenever you're describing a worldview, what do you mean by a worldview, and how does film incorporate worldviews?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there's a couple different ways of really looking at worldview, and my first approach to it, and it's still a good one, is the philosophical approach, which is, you know, you understand, like I mentioned earlier, if you begin to understand that worldviews all have an ethic and ontology and a epistemology, and you understand how that works, you understand how that works in Christianity, then you can pick it out in a philosophy and interact with it. Like, well, how do you know what you're saying is true? You know, That's epistemology. Or, well, you say relativism. Oh, everything's relative and there's no right and wrong. Okay, so if I murdered you right now, I wouldn't be wrong. You know, those are the different ways of addressing these elements of worldviews. But you know, as I studied storytelling, I started to realize that there's another element, another way of understanding worldview, and it's a little bit more, I don't know, I guess you'd call it artistic or whatever, but and that is that a worldview is a story, it's a narrative. And this is actually more for the postmodern world, which has recognized the power of stories. And a worldview is a story. And it does incorporate, you know, the reality, what is real, what is knowable. It incorporates all those, but incorporates it in a story way. You know what I mean? And so, for example, you know, the way that I might, reduce that to a simple understanding would be story is basically has four elements: creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. And in other words, every story is going to have a notion of creation, meaning what is the world? What was the world like ideally? You know, and then what's wrong with it? That's fall, meaning, and of course, these are obviously Christian terms that I'm using, but every worldview has a view that the way the world what used to be was one way and or should be one way, right? This is how the world should be, but it's not because of this, right? So, and then that's the fall, and then, creation, fall, redemption is how do we get back to that? How do we fix it? How do we fix it? And then, of course, restoration would be eschatology, or in other words, what would be the future perfect utopia sort of thing? You know, what would be the where is everything going? That type of a thing. And so you find that every Christian or every worldview has these story elements to it. And you can spot them once you're familiar with them, and you know, understanding how they work with your faith as well as a Christian. So, for example, you know, I think one of the most popular, funny, but you know, ironically, one of the most popular Christian philo or Christian, I keep saying that word. One of the most popular philosophies, and I address this in my book, is existentialism in Hollywood movies in particular, you know. And if you've ever heard that term, you know, it sounds a little highfalutin, but you know, you might even have heard, oh yeah, Jean-Paul Sartre and Camus and you know, Jasper Johns and some of these, you know, existentialists. And it can kind of sound like it's removed and academic, but it's really not, because actually in some ways, I might be an existentialist myself if I wasn't a Christian. So existentialism, and of course there are different varieties of, you know, there's no absolute worldview for any worldview, whether it's humanism or Buddhism or whatever. But you know, existentialism has varieties, but it's basically the notion is its notion of creation is that we just exist. There's no God. We just exist. We are thrust out into existence. So in other words, stop asking yourself, who created us? Where did we come from? We just are. There's no God. And so therefore, you know, and the fall is that man created religion in order to control other people and to control other things and morals. You know, all systems are all human created to control people. So the redemption is how do you get out of the system? Well, you have to, you know, you have to realize that you are a you totally individual, totally responsible for everything in your life, and you know, not it's all up to you. Therefore, you are your own creator, so to speak. You create yourself through your choices. Choice becomes the sort of, you know, it becomes a god in a way. But you know, so your choice, all the power in your life is in your will and your choice, and so it's all up to you, type of thing. And you know, then you know, who knows whatever the ultimate view of restoration would be in this view. But those three elements are certainly a strong part of that. And you know, this how does this come? How does this flesh out in various stories? Well, There's a lot of them, and I don't keep track of all of them. I try to give some examples in my book, and sometimes they're very obscure. People don't know they're more artsy movies. But one example I might pick would be Forrest Gump. That's a classic all-time movie, right? That was existentialist. Remember how existentialism likes to talk a lot about chance versus destiny, or predetermination versus chance, right? Well, remember the Forrest Gump, the feather in the air, and Forrest is actually go, is everything all like by chance that floats around just like a feather, or do we all have a destiny? And the various characters in the Forrest Gump story embody these various views of destiny versus chance. Like Lieutenant Dan, he believed in destiny. He believed he was supposed to die a glorious death in the wars, like his previous family, previous, grandfather and father did before him, and he wasn't able to, so he had no meaning in his life, and he was about to kill himself. And there are existentialists that do actually conclude that, well, there's no real meaning in life because there's no God, there's no purpose. You just create your own. And so if there, but some people go, well, if there really is no purpose, there's no meaning of God, well, then why bother living, and they'll kill themselves. And Lieutenant Dan was on the verge of that, but then of course, he sort of recognizes, and he has a sort of a religious epiphany as he fights the God and the hurricane type of thing. And then of course, Forrest Gump is this character who's like, doesn't know what he's doing, and he ends up affecting history, right? And that's part of the belief of chance, right? And so, it's all these people seeking for significance and meaning and purpose in life, and they're finding there isn't any, or it's just by chance or whatever. You have to create your own meaning in life. And at the end, Forrest concludes, I don't know, maybe it's both. Maybe life is a feather and everything's destiny, which is kind of ludicrous, but philosophically it's contradictory, right? But nevertheless, it's sure, Forrest Gump was a, obviously a tremendously entertaining movie, but it shows you. By the way, I was actually in Hollywood at the time, and I met the writer, and I at the time I was like, I asked him, so were you deliberately writing existentialism? Because I saw it all over the place. He goes, oh yeah, definitely. So, what people don't realize is that writers, storytellers, we do have an agenda. And we're not just telling entertaining stories. I think a lot of the Christians know that by now in general, but we are deliberately incorporating what we believe very consciously, because when you study the nature of storytelling, you realize, like I said, it's a story of conversion. So if you realize how the story of the hero progresses, you realize, oh, it's a story of them converting, and so what do I think about life that I want the hero to learn? Well, that's going to be my worldview, right? So, the book Hollywood Worldviews was about helping Christians to first begin to take seriously worldviews, and that's something that, you mentioned this earlier. Some people are more intellectual than others. It's not better or worse. It's just different. Some people more intellectual. Some people more emotional. Some people more artistic. I happen to be, I consider myself bipolar. I'm both of them, and they fight each other sometimes. But nevertheless, the intellectual types might be more attuned to this than other people who are more emotional or less intellectual, don't care about that kind of stuff. But it's real, and you've got humanism. Humanism believes that man is the measure of all things, and there are varieties of humanisms. But ultimately, it rejects God as well, and it believes that the answer to our problems is looking within the human soul and rejecting God so that we can become our own gods, type of thing. So there's a lot of commonalities and similarities between these worldviews. You've got, feminism, and there are, of course, Buddhism and things. There are Eastern views, and of course, in a lot of Hollywood movies, whenever you see whenever they're dealing with an Eastern worldview versus a Western worldview, it's often, Western worldview is limited, and Eastern worldview is a little bit more about wisdom, that kind of a thing. So these things are going on all over the time, all over the place, and everywhere, and you can understand it better and catch it if you first understand the nature of worldviews and study them. So it requires a little bit of You've got to put some energy into this, some
Mm.
effort into this, folks. You got to say, okay, let me learn about worldviews. What are the different worldviews? What are the different components? And the more I know about it, then I can spot it else, when I'm talking to people, when I'm watching a movie. So I did a little bit of that in the book. And then I talked about storytelling, a story structure, and how, like I said, how it is a paradigm of conversion. And try to give examples so I could help to flesh it out, that kind of a thing, And if we go into the storytelling aspect, I explain in the book how a story is a roughly a hero's journey. Again, there are varieties of storytelling. There's Eastern storytelling and Western storytelling, but I do think that the Western storytelling is based on ultimately a Christian paradigm in a way. And what do I mean by that? Well, I explain this in the book, where every story usually basically has a hero. Some might call them the protagonist, but sometimes the protagonist is different than the hero. Like in Braveheart, the hero is actually William Wallace, right? Braveheart. But the protagonist, the guy telling the story, is Robert the Bruce. But nevertheless, you've got a protagonist, the main character, and they actually are on a journey. They have a normal world in which, their life is one way, and then a call to adventure enters into their world, meaning, some traumatic thing that calls them to adventure, and they usually are reluctant. They don't want to do it because they want their normal life. This is how we all are, right? I don't want to deal with this, but then they get to the point where they're forced to actually accept that call and go on that journey. And so, for instance, I talk about how in Braveheart, William Wallace just wants to be married. Of course, he was his father and his whole family was killed, and he was an orphan taken care of by his uncle, right? And that's where he learned how to fight and all that kind of stuff. So when he comes back to his Scotland, he just wants to marry and have a family and live peacefully. But of course, the king comes, and the king is he wants England, he wants Scotland for himself. And they do prima nocta, which is, the first night with the nobles. And William Wallace doesn't want to give his wife up to that immoral thing. So he marries in secret and all this. Well, in the short of it, they catch him, they kill his wife. And when they kill his wife, that makes him accept the journey. Okay, I'm going to fight the King of England. At first, he's like, I don't want to fight. I just want to have a, be married and live peacefully. But once they kill his wife, that's the thing that then changes. It's called the turning point, or plot point, or whatever. And it's a turning point that launches him on the journey. Okay, now I'm going to fight the King of England because of what he did. He murdered my wife, type of thing. So then that hero then gathers their allies. So that's why you see in many movies, people, the hero will have various friends and sometimes a sidekick, right? And of course, in Braveheart, he gets his soldiers start to join him around him, and they got all these really interesting characters and Irishmen and all this. And then those allies, and then that hero then faces goal. I'm sorry, they face obstructions to their goal. But there's one element of the hero too. They're after a goal. They have to be obsessively after a goal, something they want so bad they're willing to give up everything to achieve it. And that's the thing that drives the story, right? If it's not going to be an interesting story if the hero doesn't want something really badly, right? And of course, in Braveheart, he wants revenge, or he wants Scotland to be free, actually. That's what he really wants. But he also wants to get revenge for his wife, right? So, the hero's driven by this goal, but there's always a inner flaw inside them. It could be the way they look at the world. It could be something, their understanding of the world. But there's something, even though they're the good guys, even though we're on their side, they're actually not seeing the world quite correctly. They have something to learn. And their journey to after going after their goal ultimately is what forces them to face up to, as the villain comes in, and of course, or the antagonist, and as they battle over through the middle of the movie, battling over, you know, these goals and stuff, it gets to the point where the hero loses everything, and everything's lost. He's going to lose everything, right? And that's when they have the dark night of the soul or in some way, and they realize, you know, what I want is not what I need. And they're coming to the end of their rope is what forces them to realize that they have an inner flaw, something inside them that needs to change. And when they do that, they get the inner strength to fight the outer enemy, who's the villain or the antagonist. And then you have the final conflict, the final battle. So, you know, in Braveheart, of course, William Wallace is fighting for freedom and all this, and he's very heroic, but he's driven by revenge, you know? And ultimately, vengeance is not satisfying. So freedom is a good thing, but vengeance isn't. So it's not until he actually gets caught and he's in the jail and he's facing the reality he's going to be tortured and murdered by the king. That's when he realizes that, I'm not going to achieve my goal. But what I really need to do is I need to die to myself. And he realizes that he has to be a sacrifice. In a way, it's his sacrifice that he gives up. And by giving up and giving in and, you know, he gets tortured, that becomes the inspiration for the Robert the Bruce to then go on and get the freedom in Scotland that William Wallace couldn't achieve. So, you know, so when the hero has this revelation of which, by the way, you know, Braveheart was written by a Christian, and it's very much of a Christ-like story, you know, and this is a very common element as well. But my point is that this notion of freedom, and it's all about freedom, but it's really about more than just freedom. It's about, well, how do you get freedom? Do you get freedom by compromising with evil, or do you get freedom by fighting evil? You know, and so the movie, so in one way, that story is like the conversion of the protagonist. They want something, but in the end, they realize they need something different than what they thought they wanted. And that's where their personal growth is. And that's, of course, what conversion is. Now, obviously, it's not always Christian conversion, right? So depending on what worldview you have, you're communicating, you know, maybe a person is religious, and you know, we see this a lot in movies, right? Someone's very, very religious, an Orthodox Jew or Christian, and they're all fuddy-duddy, or they're all judgmental. And then they, you know, they get to be friends with a gay person, and they realize that they're too judgmental, and they have to get rid of their Christianity and realize that everyone's love should be loved and accepted, or whatever, something like that. And Christianity is judgmental. And that, of course, is a conversion as well, right? That's a conversion, an anti-conversion, where you're realizing that humanism is the answer. We need to give up religion, and that's what makes us more compassionate, right? Mm. So this is what stories do. You know, this is one of the several ways in which they're communicating their worldview. And ultimately, you know, if you're not aware, then one of the things I would always tell people is, look, it's going to be communicating a worldview to you whether you know it or not. If you don't realize it, you're going to be manipulated, because you're going to follow. Because what happened? We root for the hero, right? We like them. Yeah, win. But then as we are rooting for them, we are emotionally connecting to the hero. So we're going on the journey with them so that we are going to be converted like the hero is converted. By the time the hero realizes how he sees the world wrong, we're going to realize, yeah, we have that too in us. And again, you're going to do it consciously or not. And if you're not aware, then you're going to be easily manipulated. But if you're aware, if you're consciously seeing how they're communicating, you can at least understand, okay, here's what they're trying to tell me. Here's what I don't agree with. Here's what I don't like. And you're less likely to be manipulated. That's one of the main arguments in the book. But the other side of the coin is, I think a lot of times Christians, again, they're reacting so extremely against all the, you know, sex and violence or whatever, that they're missing. There's a lot of good things in movies. There's a lot, you know, movies aren't perfect, you know, just no sermon's perfect either, right? So there's a mix of good and bad, but there's a lot of good that a lot of people miss, a lot of Christians miss, because they're just reacting against it. So, you know, I list a lot of good movies that I think, okay, here are secular movies that I think have a good, strong meaning that could be either Christian or positive towards the Christian worldview. You know, so for example, some of the later movies that I give an example are is Hacksaw Ridge, which was also made by Mel Gibson. You know, that was a powerful true story about World War II and a Christian Seventh-day Adventist and his faith and how it interacts with the world. But there's also movies like, you've got the movie, the Ben-Hur movie that came out, you know, not just the Christian movies, but movies like Les Miserables, right? Les Miserables is basically a Christian redemption story. Yeah. And every few years they do a new version of it because it's one of the most amazing stories of all time, right? And it's very much of a story of Christianity.
Yeah.
Even if it's not explicitly so, you know. Yeah. But there's also, you know, one of the things that I like to defend is horror movies. Yeah. A lot of Christians think, oh, horror is bad because, you know, that's obviously evil and stuff. But really, horror movies are a lot about, they're one of the best tools or genres for our postmodern world. In a postmodern world, everything's relative, right? There, you know, you can't judge other people with your religious beliefs. One man's freedom fighter is another man's terrorist. So there's this sort of all values are relative. Well, if all values are relative, then there's no such thing as evil, right? And so evil is just your personal subjective opinion, right? But someone else might disagree with you. But a horror movie shows you, no, there's real evil. Because yeah. when you watch a horror movie, you go, yeah, that's really evil. And that monster or that guy, that serial killer, whatever it is, deserves to die in the end. Mm. And that's a very strong moral fable. And then, of course, there's a lot of, you know, sometimes if they deal with the demonic, Christianity will be directly related to it. Like, for instance, Paranormal Activity. That was a secular movie, but was very much of a Christian message. And the filmmakers didn't even necessarily intend it to be so. But also, like, movies like Deliver Us from Evil, which was a Hollywood cop story with a demon possession involved in it. And the movie's very strongly about confession of sin and repentance, you know. So it's like, wow, these elements can be very powerful even in a secular movie. And that was my goal with To End All Wars.
Yeah.
I was telling the story of To End All Wars, and it was a true story, World War II. Ernest Gordon was this English POW under the Japanese, and he gets into this prisoner of war camp, and they're brutalized by the Japanese. They're just brutalized. Mm. And it's his journey about where he begins with a sort of a, you know, the Western versus the Eastern view. He's got the Western survival of fittest, Darwin, all this type of thing, you know, take care of yourself. But then eventually they lose hope and they start dying off, and they're being brutalized by the Japanese, who are the Eastern worldview. But then ultimately they find some books, they find Plato, they find a Bible, Shakespeare, and they realize, let's give the guys hope. Let's start a jungle university where we have classes and teach them about Shakespeare. And well, the Bible was one of those books, and they started teaching this stuff, and it's changed the men's lives. They started becoming Christians, applying it to their life, and it turned the whole camp around, and ultimately it helped them confront their abusers, the Japanese, and with forgiveness in a way that is still powerful to anyone who watches the story. And so that was like an East meets West story where there's some truth in both East and West. It's not, one's not superior to the other, because there's a higher kingdom than both of those, and that's the kingdom of God. But in the end, you know, stars Kiefer Sutherland, James Cosmo, Robert Carlyle, in the end, it's, you know, it's basically your typical Chariots of Fire secular movie, but it has a strong Christian worldview to it. And that's kind of what it's become legendary for.
Yeah. You know, growing up as a Christian, growing up in a Christian home, my parents were very cautious about what we watched. And so I remember the days when we had the old TV Guardian, and half the movie you couldn't even hear because it was silent, you know. and now I think something that I'm seeing that you bring to light here is Christians often look at movies in that sense of, okay, how many curse words are in the film? How much sex is in the film? Is there nudity? Is there, and I think there's some good in that. I definitely think there's some good. I'm glad that growing up I wasn't able to watch whatever I wanted to watch, especially as a teenage boy, just be able to watch whatever you want to watch. But on the flip side, what you're getting at here, especially with Hollywood worldviews, is that Christians seem to miss the deeper thing that's embedded in the film, the message, the worldview, the story. And your film that you did the screenplay for To End All Wars, it's a rated R film, and it's definitely got some brutal moments. And I told you before the podcast, I watched it over the week again, and but yet when the colonel gives up his life for the one who tried to escape and he's crucified on a cross like Christ, I mean, it's so powerful. It's such an emotional scene. There's so much going on there that's so just explicitly Christian. And even the horror films, we did an entire podcast on horror films already with Dr. Philip Tallon, where we talked about the redeeming quality in these horror films, and that they represent something beyond the material world, which today materialism is a worldview that is just everything that exists is in the real world, physical world, it's tangible. When you watch horror films, especially those that deal with the supernatural or the spiritual, all of a sudden it awakens something in us that, oh, I think there might be more to this world than just what I see in the physical realm. So, all that
Absolutely.
said, I wonder what you would say, if you would give any advice to Christians on how to get beyond just, I understand, putting some restrictions on what you watch, especially if you have kids
Sure.
and parents putting restrictions on films. But how can Christians move beyond just the top layer of just watching for sex, profanity, and violence? You do a great chapter on this in your book, because if the Bible were put on the screen, we would have a rated R film, if not much worse than that. So.
Absolutely. That's one of my arguments. And I want to deconstruct the common, I think the common stereotype and like I said, it's not as much of a problem now as it used to be. But I do, and like you said, I do acknowledge that there is too much sex and violence, right? And so it doesn't mean everything's acceptable. But when you begin to say, well, now wait a minute, just because the movie's dealing with adultery doesn't mean it's glorifying adultery. Because if you understand the nature of storytelling, I've had to do this with my wife many times. Like we'll start watching a movie and there's guys doing some bad stuff in the beginning. She's just like, I can't handle this. I'm like, yeah, but honey, don't worry, because they're showing they're gonna end up changing by the end of the movie, and they'll realize that they were wrong. So you've got to accurately depict sin if you want your redemption to have power and accuracy as well. And so and then, like you mentioned, once you realize that, wow, you face the fact that there's a lot of R-rated material in the Bible. And my goal was to sort of break down this common misconception about, sex and violence is all bad, and realizing that, and by the way, even with Hollywood movies, yeah, there's a lot of glorification at times, but a lot of it is not in there for that reason. A lot of it is to accurately show the world in its sin or depravity, excuse me, or whatever they might call it. But because they also believe in redemption, they may not believe in Christian redemption, but they also believe that the world's bad. And you've got to, my message is always, you have to accurately depict sin, or the redemption will have no power. And so this is why a lot of times with Christian movies, they've got these like 1970s television bad guys, and I don't even believe it, and I'm a Christian, And so that's the kind of stuff that just doesn't work and doesn't connect. It doesn't ring true, right? So, but once you realize, okay, there's a reason behind sin, and you have to know your limits, right? Because obviously, if it gets pornographic and stuff, then that becomes a very big issue, and or excessive violence. Not all violence is acceptable, but it is interesting though, because I think the Christians tend to be more accepting of violence than of sexuality. But the truth is some of the, strongest moral movies really have that, wrestle with adultery. Remember Fatal Attraction, that old classic, but also, more recent years, Faithful, or I think it was called, no, Unfaithful. And that was the reverse. It was the woman who was unfaithful, but there was grace, and there was understanding and forgiveness, and how do you get out of that type of thing? So, so when they realize that just because there's sin is depicted in the movie doesn't mean it's glorifying. It actually might be setting you up to show that this is not good, and in the end, it will be, you know, it will be ultimately negative, right? And actually, there's a lot of movies where that is the case. It really is. But you have to, yeah, like I say, you have to kind of make your own guidelines, especially if you have kids. I realize, look, I wouldn't want to expose my kids to the things. I wouldn't want my kids to drink alcohol, but it's okay to drink alcohol for adults. I wouldn't want my kids to drive a car until they're an adult and can drive a car. Well, the same thing. I wouldn't want my kids to be watching things on television before their maturity level is there. And so absolutely, you have to have those lines that you draw for your family, et cetera, and for yourself. If you got a weakness for pornography, then you probably shouldn't be watching movies where there's nudity and stuff. You can close your eyes at the scenes, because a lot of times the scenes are short, you know, or fast forward. Of course, you can't fast forward anymore. We don't have the VHS, but you can bump forward on the DVD or whatever, you know. In fact, Netflix has the 10-second bouncing, you know.
Yeah.
So you can do stuff like that, or if it starts to become too excessive, you may bow out and say, okay, this is too much. I'm not gonna, you know. Absolutely, absolutely. But it's finding that balance. It's finding that balance and realizing that just because the movie has sex and violence in it doesn't mean it's glorifying it. It actually might be, the intent is oftentimes the opposite.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've got one last question for you. And this was actually a question that was posed to me recently on an interview, and I couldn't answer it. So no pressure if this is not a good question. Are you the type that keeps a top five film list, or do you just have any films that are at the very top of your list? Are you that type of guy, or?
Yeah. You know, I'm not, I have a list. I'll give you some of them that I started years ago, but I haven't updated it.
Yeah.
But I have, there is a sort of like a top three in my mind. And I noticed over the years, things kind of fell out naturally. And To End All Wars was one of the top three all the time, I confess. But it's not because it's me. It's, you know, I wrote it based on someone else's story. So, yeah. And the director directed it, not me. So, but nevertheless, I don't keep a strict list, you know, because it's more like a top 10 or 20 type of thing. Yeah. But nevertheless, yeah, I kind of do. And I actually kind of did it more for other people asking me too. And most of them are going to be more the older movies now, but I would say there is a kind of a all-time favorite, and it used to be Chariots of Fire. Like Chariots of Fire in the 80s, I think 81 or something when it came out, that was the movie as a Christian where it won an Oscar, made by secular people, secular movie, but it had a positive, strong Christianity in it. That's the movie that told me, okay, it is possible. It's near impossible, but nonetheless, it is possible. You can do it. And that's what I wanted to do. So when, by the time my movie To End All Wars came out, I was proud that some people had likened it to Chariots of Fire, because that was my goal. And so Chariots of Fire had always been my all-time favorite, but over the years, now it's Braveheart. Yeah, it's Braveheart. It's definitely Braveheart. There's just something about the movie. It embodies the gospel. It's got action. I love action. It's got romance. I love romance. You know, I'm not a typical guy. I'm a typical guy that I love all the action stuff, and you know, I love guy movies, but I also like chick flicks, you know, and I love all kinds of genres and stuff. So, but Braveheart, I think, you know, just has it all, and it's the kind of movie that you could watch over and over again. I'm not a person who watches a lot of movies over and over again, very, very rarely, but that's one of the ones, you know. But also, there's another one that I kind of have in my top 10 that I like to, it's a really obscure movie, hard to get, but it's called The Addiction. And it's a horror film about vampires, black and white, and Abel Ferrara made the movie. And it has Lily Taylor in it and Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
But what I loved about it was it's an art house film, so it's weird, it's not got a strong storyline, but it is there, and it is a metaphor it uses vampirism in the movie as a metaphor for original sin. And so it's got a very Christian worldview, but it's a very secular movie. And so you've got these vampires who, and in fact, it was a movie that inspired me in some of my movies that I've written and novels. And so the vampires basically are the epitome of sin without accountability, meaning they realize that in a godless universe that there's no right or wrong. So you just feed, you know, there's just eat or be eaten, right? And the story is about a philosophy student in New York. So she philosophizes, and there's one point in the movie where the vampires quote R.C. Sproul, which was really funny, and not in a positive way because they don't like R.C. Sproul, but that's what I found really fascinating. So the addiction is one of the ones that in my top 10, that's an odd one that most people have not seen. And I like to recommend it for those who are willing to check out something that's sort of very different and weird, but got a very strong Christian underlying thing to it. And, you know, it's not like it has to be a Christian, explicitly Christian worldview. One of my all-time favorites is also Sense and Sensibility, you know, the Ang Lee movie, you know, which is Jane Austen. And it's just about what is true love, you know, what is true love founded on, you know, that kind of a thing. So, yeah, so I do have some of those. Amadeus is another old classic that I highly recommend because it's another story about, it's something I actually relate to and a lot of artists struggle with. Am I Amadeus? You know, we want to be Mozart's artist, right? Who was that guy? Salieri it was his story. It was like the story being told through the eyes of the villain. Because he hates Mozart, because Mozart's blessed and gifted by God, but Mozart is this, like, he's like a pagan, right? And Salieri wants to serve God, but he's mediocre in his talent. And he's like, God, he gets so angry, why are you doing this? So he decides he wants to destroy God's creation if he's not going to be able to be blessed with that gift. Because it's so he fights against God by trying to destroy Mozart. And of course, in the end, he goes insane because you can't fight God and win. And so, you know, to me, that's a powerful, powerful message about the nature of accepting God's will in our life, you know, and especially for artists, you know.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I could go on. There's more, but Fight Club, actually.
Yeah.
Tender Mercies. These are, a lot of these are really, I guess, old by my. Oh, I put Hacksaw Ridge on there. Yeah, Hacksaw Ridge and The Incredibles. But Hacksaw Ridge was one of the more recent movies that is definitely one of my all-time favorites. Mr. Holland's Opus is another one. It's just a very, you know, with Richard Dreyfuss, and it's a story about the guy who wants to be. I love the artist movies. He's the guy who wants to become a composer, a famous composer, but he has to have a day job, and the day job is teaching high school students, and it consumes his life, and he never becomes a composer. But he ultimately learns that that people are your composition. You know, people are what matter in life, not just your art, you know. So these are powerful, beautiful themes that I need. I love them because I need them. I'm not that way. I need to be encouraged in those values that I believe in, but I need to be more like, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, man, thanks for sharing those with us. Thank you for taking some time out for the podcast. I really do appreciate you coming on, and I know our listeners have probably learned a few things just from our conversation. I'm going to link up your book and your website. Is there any other places that you recommend people go if they want to find more of your work?
Yeah, no, my website is pretty detailed and helpful if you want to learn more about it. Or, you know what, if you just, everything's at Amazon. I have all my books are in audio format, paperback, or ebook on Amazon exclusively. And you know, you go to Amazon and there, all the books are explained in the book description. So you just go straight there if you really want to check it out and see what to buy, you know. But yeah, so and my novels as well, like you said, we didn't talk about that, and my novels are a way that I apply everything we talked about today in storytelling as well. So
yeah. Well, there you have it, folks. Go check out his website and follow Brian's work. It's really good stuff. And again, I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me. The rock removed and he saved us. Wasn't the Tomb Raider. I got some new flavor. I'll let you later. I beat the beast and I feast with God at a new table. In the valley is right, keeping my view stable. Remove the debt with a payment. Gonna see some new payment. So who's saying I got something for